Hey everyone, welcome. Thanks for tuning in. It is September 28th, 2023. A couple quick things before we get to the episode with director John Nix. My band, Drums Dream, is playing a handful of shows next month. We'll be in Oakland, LA, San Diego, and Gainesville at the Fest, which is reportedly sold out. These will be our last shows of the year, and you can still get tickets to the California shows, but they're going fast, so go to jeromesdreamforever.com/tour, and we hope to see you at those shows next month. Please subscribe to the pod if you haven't already, and please share it with your friends on social and everywhere else. I see a lot of you already doing this, and it's very, very appreciated. Don't forget to rate and review the pod. And be sure to follow us on Instagram at Microspy Music. I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. It was great to speak with John about his incredible documentary on Justin Pearson. I'll have links in the description for you to see the film and to learn more about John. It was a great conversation. We covered a lot of ground. We ended up talking for almost 2 hours, so I had to edit this down a little bit. But I think you're going to enjoy it. So again, thanks for tuning in, and let's get into it. You're listening to Microspy, a podcast that takes a closer look at the lives and work of musicians and creatives I admire. My name is Eric Ratzenberger. In this episode, I speak with John Nix, co-founder of Turnstile Films and director of his most recent release, Don't Fall in Love with Yourself, a documentary on the life of Justin Pearson from The Locust, 3-1-G, and Def Club. We talk about John's childhood and how movies and disposable cameras got him through difficult times. We speak about storytelling and the mysterious physiological ways film and music can affect us. We delve deep into his process of making this incredible documentary and all the learnings that came with it. So without further ado, here is my conversation with John Nix. Okay, sweet. Hey, nice to officially connect with you. I know we've been going back and forth for a little while, and finally we got to get this on the books. I'm stoked to connect with you and talk to you about the new film and, you know, your background as a filmmaker and all that, and yeah, everything else that is kind of coming up surrounding the release of this film.
Yeah, for sure, man.
Where are you right now? Where do you live?
Cleveland.
Oh, you're in Cleveland. Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. And so what's the show tonight that you're going to?
I'm going to Swans tonight. I went to Ash Nico last night. So it's
Oh, that's right.
And then I'm going to see Nick Cave tomorrow. So it's a big weird week.
Yeah, it's jam-packed.
Mm-hmm.
And you said you've seen Swans before.
Yeah, I saw them. I can't remember which album. I think it was, I want to say it was like on the To Be Kind tour, maybe, before. So
yeah,
I've seen them one other time.
Yeah, they came through here like last week, and I unfortunately missed it. My friend Jeff, who also plays in Drums Dream, he's just like, dude, you have to go. Like, you know, like you're going to regret it if you don't make it. And of course, I didn't make it. He unfortunately couldn't go because he was on dad duty.
Yeah, I know, I get that. I know. I will say that it's one of the craziest shows I've ever been to, just from a physiological standpoint. I've been to a lot of loud shows. My friend Ted plays in a band called Orphaned. That's very, very loud. Like that's like their thing that they want to do. But since Swans plays for like 3 hours straight, I just remember like at the end of their set, they do a big, like, kind of like crashing round table kind of thing of like a jazz band where it's just like, and then on trumpet, this guy, you know, and he introduces the whole band. And then the music sort of suddenly cuts out at the end of that. And then I just remember like my eyes like pouring tears, but I wasn't crying. It was just like my body being like, oh, thank God it's over. Like, we're not being bombarded by sound waves anymore. It was the most bizarre response I've ever had to like a performance before. So,
you know, it's funny that you mentioned this kind of like visceral reaction, because it reminds me, this was so long ago, but I saw Godspeed You Black Emperor in Boston. I don't know what year it was. This was like eons ago, but I had a similar response, and there was actually a moment where I don't remember if it was like of the violinist or viola player, but there was just one particular moment in the set where it was just the violin or just the viola, and I uncontrollably just started like sobbing. And it's kind of wild that music has that capability to almost like bypass sort of your you know, perceived control of your emotions, and it somehow just like gets into you, and then it just causes this reaction. It was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, when I think that speaks to like the need for like pits and valleys in songwriting, like I end up not thinking of like very brutal metal bands that are just like constantly just throttling the whole time. I end up not thinking of them as like heavy, because it becomes a wall of sound and everything sort of like evens out, and where it just sort of becomes like a white noise sort of a thing. So I find that stuff kind of calming, where like when you have music that can have these like sparse moments and everything kind of dies down, I feel like that can really penetrate and become really vulnerable and give a heft to the song that maybe something that's just like being brutal constantly doesn't have.
Oh yeah. It's all about dynamic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what were some of your first exposures to music that made you feel that way? Like, when in your younger years did you kind of realize that music can go deeper than just listening to something on the radio? Like, what was your point of entry to, I guess you would call it underground music, or music that had more meaning than like a hooky chorus?
So I have kind of like two phases with that. I'm 35. So like, as I was sort of like finding like culture for the first time or whatever, it was really like nu metal. I mean, that was what was exploding. And a lot of it was like bands that had really interesting like lore around them. Like, I got very, very into Slipknot when they first came out because of all the crazy like Ross Robinson stories and the making of that album, and like not keeping a take unless he puked when he was doing vocals, and just like that kind of stuff around it. And then once I hit like high school, all sort of in the same like 6 month to 10 month period, however long it was, I found like Discord and 31G and Saddle Creek and like all this stuff like all at once, and so it like really changed and like multi-layered my listening, where I wasn't just listening to either like pop punk or like nu metal. I was like now I was super into Cursive and Fugazi and like all like just all those types of bands. Blood Brothers was like a big entry point for me for 31G.
And were you going to shows around this time of discovery of all these bands? Like, were you going to any like local shows or anything like that?
Some, but not like not a ton. I feel like not until around the end of high school did I have like the means to afford to like go to a bunch of shows. So I was going to a lot of shows where like I could get comped in, where like my friends' like shitty bands were opening. So like my first show ever was Ice-T's Body Count, because my friend's like shitty nu metal band was opening for it. And like I would go to a lot of just you know, like weirdo kind of punk stuff. I grew up in Florida, but I moved up to Ohio, to this rural area called Lodi, that's a real shithole. That's like, it was the northern capital of the KKK for a long time. There's really like not a lot to do there. And so like all the weirdos really kind of like stuck together as a unit. So I had friends that would put on shows at like VFW halls or just like in people's garages, or there'd be like barn shows at some people's places. So like that's where it ended up being at until I had a little more money and like had a job and more free time to actually go to shows once I was like 17, 18, 19.
What led you there?
But when I was a kid, I was basically a caregiver for my grandparents. Around the time I was 8, my grandpa got diagnosed with Parkinson's, and my grandma had emphysema and asthma and a bunch of other like lung problems. So I basically had to like take care of them. And then once my grandpa died, my grandma, who was a devout Catholic, had a brood of children, was like, "Why don't we move back to Ohio, where a lot of my other kids live? So it's not all on like you and your mom." And so we like moved back up here so she could kind of like say goodbye to her kids, but also like so there'd be kind of a lifeline that wasn't just like us having to take care of her, you know.
Do you have brothers and sisters as well, or was it just you and your mom?
No, I'm an only child.
Yeah. And so you at that time, how old were you roughly?
When I moved up here.
Yeah, and then like when you were, you know, caring for your grandparents.
I was caring for them between 8 and 16, and then we moved up here when I was 14.
Wow, so that's a lot of pressure for a kid to take on.
I mean, I think, you know, it's good and bad. You know, I mean, when you're a kid, you don't really have a compass. You know, kids are really resilient because they don't have expectations the way that adults do. So you kind of just go like, well, this is probably just like how people live, right? But at the same time, like I think it gave me a good work ethic. I'm bad with free time, and I don't really like know what to do with myself when I don't have something going on. Because like if I wasn't taking care of her, I also went to Catholic school from kindergarten to 8th grade, so I was like very regimented there, and I was also like an altar boy on the weekends, so I had like a part-time job basically since like I can remember. So I've always liked doing things all the time. So that was at least like a good standard for me to set for myself, where like, no, I shouldn't just be sitting around. I should be doing something.
Well, speaking of doing something, where did filmmaking come into the mix? Like, what was your earliest memory of, you know, having any kind of interest or exposure to it that kind of prompted you to go further with it?
I mean, I've loved movies as far as I could remember. I mean, my mom was preoccupied all the time, so movies were basically like my babysitter as a kid, and it was a really cheap way to entertain me. That wasn't, you know, some big expensive toy that just came on the market. We had this awesome video store right up the street from us called, I think, Movie King is what it was called. Just like a mom and pop place, but they had a deal where you could get like 5 movies for $5 for 5 days, and so like that was my weeknights every week, where I would just go in on like Sunday night and run in and grab like 5 things and then come back out.
What were some of the films that you were watching when you were younger?
Oh, like Back to the Future, Indiana Jones, like all the big ones. And then, you know, as I got older, I started getting really into like the horror section and like just the weirdo section. Like I remember seeing the cover of Pink Flamingos for the first time and like not knowing what it was, like just like what is divine? Like what is this? I don't have like there's nothing in my brain that I have like a language for what this thing is. And so I would start seeking out more and more bizarre stuff. I'd also get those I don't even remember what they're like, the Columbia House type magazines,
Oh
where
yeah,
you know
old
you
school.
buy one VHS and then like you get like 10 for free or whatever fake fine print thing. But I would just use those as catalogs. Like that was like my IMDb as a kid, where I would just go through and I would like highlight all these things. So I was very like anal retentive about like seeing movies from a pretty early age. Like I be became a completist very early.
So in a way, that's almost like a way of study or absorption, you know, it's like just watching films all the time, every week, you're just watching something new, something different. I imagine that kind of almost shaped your visual palette in a lot of ways, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Every once in a while I'll watch a movie for purely for pleasure. You know, something I've seen 100 times that like I just like having on as like a tone and a feeling. But yeah, I mean, I usually am looking at it as study and as work. Not even necessarily in reference to my own film work, but just like understanding it, understanding how it's built and how it's functioning and like how it's achieving what it's achieving. Because sometimes it's not obvious, and you just have to keep watching it over and over. Like, why does this edit work? Why is it scary? Nothing's happening, but why is this pulling this off as opposed to just being sort of like stagnant and boring, like how other movies are? Like, what separates them? So I try to very actively watch everything that I watch.
Yeah, I almost feel like even when you were younger too, there probably was like a subconscious level of intake, you know, because it's almost like you're watching things and you don't really necessarily know why it's giving you a certain feeling. But then as you became more familiar with like the filmmaking process and as you dove deeper into it, that's probably when, you know, you started getting more into the technical aspect. And I mean, was the architecture of the actual storytelling something that stood out to you at a younger point, or was that something that kind of came later?
I think at a younger point it was, and every once in a while they still are kind of magic. Like I think the Safdie brothers movies are kind of magic. I don't
Yeah.
quite know how they can pull off the things that they pull off. And I think that those are the kind of movies that make me excited about making movies is that, and like how much it's making me feel and how much it's achieving. But yeah, no, I mean, from a younger age, like I didn't know exactly how you're supposed to do anything. So, I mean, there were times when I would watch movies that I loved and be like, well, I don't know how to write a screenplay because I'm 15 or whatever. But I would just write down everything that was happening and like space it out on like in a notebook and try to like understand what the structure of it is, or like when things happen, or like how, technically how far into the story things are happening. And then obviously as I got older, I learned how to like do the proper formatting and break it up.
Yeah.
In a more technical way.
Are you self-taught, or did you go to school for film?
I mean, I went to school, but it's kind of a self-taught situation because in the area that I was at in high school, there's a career center. So it's like, if you hate your home school, you can go to this place and half the day you're working in some sort of particular field. And then the other half is like normal classes. So there's everything from like automotive and nursing and fitness. So I chose the multimedia section. So I started editing when I was like 15 on Final Cut Pro. And then when I went to college, I went to this local private for-profit college that, you know, retrospectively is not that good, but it was sort of my only option. Like, I didn't have the means to get to NYU or something, or UCLA or something. But it was, they were basically like, we have a bunch of Macs with all these programs loaded onto it, kind of like, do your thing, guys. So it was kind of up to you how much time you put in and how much you spent every day. So.
And so at that point, during that time, were you kind of set on the idea of becoming a filmmaker? Was it a thing where it's like, I want to do this like for the rest of my life, or this is what I want to be?
Yeah, I mean,
for,
I knew
like, for
that,
my career.
Yeah, I mean, I knew that I wanted to do it from the time I was like five. I've never considered anything else. It's always been like filmmaking or some variation of storytelling. When I was like five, I was like, I want to be an animator. I want to make animated movies because I liked drawing. I mean, I still like drawing. It's just not a thing that I have a ton of time to do. But yeah, so it's like, it wasn't like animation or writing. It was always filmmaking. So it's always kind of like those sort of three things like together.
When did you first get your first camera?
Not until like high school. I mean, we were like dead broke for ever. I mean, I was kind of dead broke until like three or so years ago. So yeah, I mean, like the school had a bunch of equipment when I was in high school. And so like, that was the first camera I got to play with. So it was all kind of in my head up until that point.
And what about photography? Cause I know that you're also doing still photography too.
I mean, I took photos forever. Like, my mom worked at Disney World, when I was a kid. And so, like a cashier in the photo shop section, like right at the front of the park. So she would get like a deep discount on disposable cameras. So she would just get me those again as like a cheap means to preoccupy me. And so like, I would just fill up rolls of like disposable cameras, just like taking photos of whatever, like just wandering around and seeing if I could get good pictures.
Do you still have the prints of those?
No, I don't think so. I don't know. I'm assuming those got lost in the move, or I know I threw out a bunch of stuff when I was like 12, where I'm like, I'm an adult now, so I don't need kid things. So yeah, I don't know where any of that stuff would have ended up. I mean, it was, you know, I'm sure it was nothing groundbreaking or anything like that, but it was definitely a way for me to like express myself and be thinking about how to look at the world around me.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see kind of like what the lens was of like younger John, and like what you were shooting, what you're drawn to back then, and to kind of compare it to sort of where you are now, and sort of, you know, how your eye and perspective has evolved, you know?
Yeah, I mean, from what I remember, most of those photos are just like trees covered in Spanish moss and like trailer parks, and like just like there's big like storm drainage ditches all over Florida. That way, when like hurricanes come in, everything doesn't flood. So, right. I mean, I remember taking a bunch of photos of that when it's full, because it is like a surreal image that I think a lot of people don't see, where there's just like a 200 foot long, like 25 foot deep gully, just like full of mosquito water for like 6 months straight.
I'd kind of want to see some images of that, especially through like point and shoot disposable cameras. Sounds like it'd be kind of a cool series, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Florida was a weird place to grow up. it's just surreal. You know, it's like American Australia, where everyone's just like, oh, there's just like a deadly animal over there, and they kind of were just desensitized to it.
Yeah, it's like, don't mind the alligator. He'll be fine.
Yeah, I haven't gone back. I've actually been itching to the last couple of years.
Do you still have family out there?
No. I had a couple friends down there, but not anymore.
Yeah. Well, I guess it would be interesting to kind of return to there just to see like what kind of feelings are conjured up just by being in the environment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I've wanted to go back to my old neighborhood and like the place where I grew up, which was like this shitty trailer park. but go back there and see how it's changed, because I like Google Maps really hasn't like updated anything. Like, it's still photos from like 2007. So they obviously like aren't prioritizing updating that area. So who knows what that place is like at this point.
So that was a pretty rural area too, huh?
No, like everything in Florida. Not everything, but a lot of stuff in Florida is like condos and trailer parks. Like, you know, you can't build houses with basements and like big heavy foundations. So it's like kind of a practical choice to live there. It's definitely a more common thing than it is in places like the Midwest, where there's definitely like a very clear class breakdown there, where it's just like, oh, you're trash if you live there and not in like an actual house. Where I think it's more common there, where it kind of does do like a cross class kind of a thing.
Well, so now that you're in Ohio, is Ohio your home base for the foreseeable future? Or like, do you have plans to relocate somewhere else? Or is Ohio the HQ for Turnstile and your operating?
Yeah, it's definitely home base. You know, I've been out to the West Coast a bunch of times at this point, but it's just like, it's not for me. Like, I don't want to spend my entire life like being terrified I'm not going to make my like $5,000 a month rent for my shoebox. You know, I like Ohio has countless problems, but it definitely doesn't have like cost of living problems. Like, you can buy a house here. Like, we own a house, yeah. Which is like a thing growing up I didn't think I'd ever be able to do. So it seems pretty crazy to me. It's a very good practical choice from my standpoint. There's a very good group of people in Cleveland and Columbus that are doing a lot of really good work, especially bands right now. And so, and there's something about places that are like shitty red states where there's not like an entitlement to being like, oh yeah, I'm correct all the time. There's like a real anger to art here, because I think people are frustrated and they know it's not going to just come to them if they get, you know, one gallery showing in like Williamsburg or something like that. And so everyone here works really hard, and they're like, if they are doing it, they're doing it very seriously, because the other option when you live in a place like this it happens all the time, where people are just like, just get your paycheck, just stack your money, just be safe, and everything will be fine. So like, if people are doing work here, they're being really ambitious about it. So it's a lot of really cool people to work with. Plus, like, any of the cool, like, bigger connections I've been able to make are just like over the computer. Like, I, you know, as long as you like can build a rapport with people that you want to work with, I don't think it matters much where you live.
Yeah, I agree with that. Especially now, it's like easier than ever to create a solid fabric of people, you know, like-minded people or anyone who's in the space that you're involved in, whether it's filmmaking, music, you know, anything. It could be anything. It's just we're more interconnected than ever. And I mean, hence this podcast. You know, I'm in SF, you're out in Ohio, we're chatting. Mm-hmm. Like we're in the same room together. It's great. I love it.
Yeah,
That became like really clear to me during the pandemic, where it almost like forced everyone to kind of rethink the social landscape of things. And now it's just become kind of a part of the norm, you know? It's less, it's almost like to your point, it's less so about where you live and just more so about who you're interacting with and involved with. And it could be someone across the world, but you could still have like alignment and sort of, you know, your philosophies and perspectives or not. I mean, it doesn't really matter, but yeah, either way, So I did touch on Turnstile. For those who don't know, you're the co-founder of Turnstile Films. Why don't you talk about a little bit how that came about and who you partnered with and sort of what the general overview of Turnstile Films is? Because I know that you've done a lot of music videos. You've done a couple of documentaries, I believe, before this one that we're about to talk about with Justin. Mm-hmm. So how did that come about? And would you say that that was definitely a turning point in your career as a filmmaker?
So the company's just built out of a few of us from college, where we all were the ambitious ones that wanted to do something. There are a lot of people that just go to art school that are like, I made one music video. Why am I not Hype Williams? Like, why am I not super famous? And it's like, well, it doesn't work like that. Also, they don't pay. So it's not necessarily the best field to get your start in, but like from a financial perspective. But it was one of those things where I think we all kind of felt like out in the wind. You know, I was just like having panic attacks about money and writing screenplays endlessly that I knew wouldn't be able to be produced. But it was building my muscles for storytelling and like letting me process a lot of ideas that I was having. And so once like a few of us got together and we're like, should we just like do something together like consistently? So it's not these like one-off 48-hour film project kind of things or just like some little one-off like freelance thing. Like, let's try to make a company where we're just like consistently doing work together and developing as a crew. So that's how it started. And then we just tried to be as busy as we could for years, where we were just like taking on any music video from any local band, any band that was like of a bigger stature, like a Skeleton Witch, that we could get like a decent budget for. And then it just like moved on from there, where we started doing short films and short documentaries that eventually led to bigger documentaries.
Yeah, well, speaking of documentaries, Don't Fall in Love with Yourself. This film was amazing. I appreciate you sending
Thank
me the screener,
so
and I really enjoyed watching it. It's kind of wild to look at this documentary, or to watch this documentary, experience this documentary, and to be familiar with pretty much all of the players. You know, of course, mm-hmm. Justin Pearson being the star of this thing, but it's cool to see all of these other people surrounding him and getting their perspectives and recalling the time of just the timeline of all things Justin Pearson, really, and all the people surrounding him. I thought it was, I mean, for one, congratulations on this. This is like no small project, I imagine. What was the beginnings of this project, and how did it come to be? Is this a thing where you approached Justin, or were you acquainted with him before you started the film? How did this whole thing come to be?
I found Locust specifically around the time that I was like 15 or 16, and it completely blew my mind. Like, I just remember being like, I don't, again, like kind of like the divine thing, where like I don't have words for this, I don't know what it is, like I don't know how to describe it to anyone, but like it makes my like brain feel good, and it's absorbing all my anxiety, and it seems smart and like clever and like brutal, but not being like chest pumping dumb metal guy, which I was getting out of at that time. So yeah, when I was like 19, I finally reached out to him, like just like I shot him like a Facebook message and was just like, hey, I love you, your music makes, you know, is so important to me, and like I just want you to know that like I really, your art has really changed my life and has like opened so many doors for me, like aesthetically. And he actually got back to me and was like really kind and like sweet, and was just like, oh cool, yeah, that's great, like, you know, next time I roll through by you, like come to the show, let's hang out. And so he ended up playing in Pittsburgh pretty soon after that, and so we just like hung out at the show, like Retox was playing, and then we just stayed in touch after that for years, where I would just go to shows if they were in like a 3-hour radius, you know, like Detroit or Pittsburgh, Columbus, whatever. I had just been working on a project that I was kind of like burnt out by, and I was like, I need to do something that I want a passion project. Like, I need to do something that's going to make me feel really good about what I'm working on, and that I can really commit to something that's going to take years, that I'm going to feel great about. And so I just like shot him a question out of the blue. I was just like, yeah, can we do this? Can I make a documentary on you? And then he was totally receptive to it. Like, he really didn't have a lot of questions. He was just like, yeah, I trust you, let's do it. So that was surprising. I mean, I like, whenever I ask anyone anything, I'm always like, I kind of try to think out any responses they're going to have and like have rebuttals ready and try to like be ready to prove myself. And it was a situation where I didn't need to do that kind of at all.
With that, suddenly you have this open door, this opportunity to actually dive into something that really like was significant to you in terms of the music that Justin has made and just the friendship that you were establishing in the earlier days upon meeting. When you realize that, oh, this is something that I could actually do, what were some of the things that you had to do in order to kind of get it all together? Like, what was, like, what did you have to assemble, at least in the early parts or early phases of the documentary? Like, were there budgetary constraints? Was there someone who was like willing to help with that? Did you have a crew in mind already? Like, what was the scene around those early days of the beginning of filming this?
In the beginning, it was just self-financed. We run Turnstile in a pretty socialist way where, like, we don't pull money out and all the projects go towards producing more projects, and it's sort of a self-sufficient thing. There wasn't a lot of, like, permission to ask. I mean, like, that's sort of a thing that, like, I always dread about filmmaking. I don't like owing people money, and I don't like begging rich people for money and trying to be like, oh, I can make you a ton back. It'll definitely be great for you, because then I'm just going to have panic attacks about paying them back for the next 4 years of my life. So I think it was good for us to run this self-sufficiently because he's definitely a niche product that I don't think a lot of people would get. I especially don't think a bunch of people that would like just be able to write us like a bunch of money, like a fat check, would necessarily get it, at least not in Ohio. So the two big things were, once he said yes, he's like, what do you need from me? And I was like, any B-roll that you have would be awesome, because I can, like, while we're planning everything else, I can just be, like, logging all of the footage. Because when it comes on tapes, you have to, in real time, import it and save it to a hard drive. So, like, the first year was, like, spent me just, like, logging all this footage, writing down what happens at every tape with the time code, and, like, watching it as it imported. And it was about, I don't know, somewhere between, like, 150 and 200 hours of footage. And then, like, the other big starting point was flying Justin out and filming him in our studio, where we did, like, a 6.5 or so hour interview with him, where we just, like, talked about his entire life and, like, everything that had happened. And I wasn't sure how that was going to go, but he was a fucking trooper. Like, most people kind of tag out after, like, 2 hours. They kind of hit a wall, and they're like, all right, this is kind of enough for me. And you can feel them slogging, and their answers are getting slower and sort of, like, less thoughtful. Where, like, he was just like, no, keep going, anything. You literally ask me anything, keep going. Like, so I feel like we touched, like, most of the subjects. Not everything ends up in the documentary, because you can kind of only add so much with the running time. And on top of that, like, there were just certain things that, like, didn't have a nice story arc to it. So they just weren't. It's just like, oh, and then I did it all leather, and it was a band for a couple of years, and then it wasn't a band. You know, that's not necessarily, like, compelling to add into a story. Like, into a documentary. So there's stuff that didn't land in it, but yeah, I mean, we covered a ton. So those were, like, the two big things. And then finding the skeleton of the story inside of that. And then after that, we started trying to book all the other interviews to fortify everything that he said.
That's amazing, for one. But yeah, it kind of answered the question I was going to ask you about that story architecture or the story arc, and, like, how you approached that, how you were going to kind of map it out. But it seems like it was very organic in between, you know, the footage that you're, again, kind of like studying in real time while you're uploading it. You're sifting through a couple hundred hours worth of B-roll footage adjacent to your interview, you know, 6 hour interview with Justin. I feel like in real time, you're almost putting the pieces together right then and there. And how you wanted to structure the film.
Yeah, I mean, when you go into documentaries, you need to go into it with a plan. There should definitely be a structure, and then you should be willing to immediately throw it away because it's gonna be whatever it's gonna be. And I've definitely given a lot of feedback on, like, working cuts or rough cuts of my friends' documentaries, and it's just like you're fighting it, like you're fighting gravity. It's this thing wants to be this thing, and you need to, like, let it do that because it's telling you what it needs to be. Documentary is like writing a screenplay and editing a movie at the same time. So you really have to kind of go with your gut and trust what you're seeing.
Yeah, it's like active observation, right? It's almost mm-hmm. It's almost similar to conducting an interview where, you know, I might do a deep dive or do some research and, like, put together an outline of talking points with you. But you have, like, it's the same thing. You have to be willing to abandon all of it just based on what we organically end up talking about, or what you, or where you kind of take the conversation, you know? So it's like, you can't, it's like you could do hours of prep, but then, you know, talk about absolutely none of it based on just how the conversation naturally goes, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I've done a lot of interviews in my life between doing my own personal work and then my full-time job outside of this, like how I actually might pay my bills is I'm a marketing editor. So I've worked on a bunch of projects with just like, clients, the way they want like brand storytelling, where you make like little mini docs about their companies and stuff. So I've seen a lot of interviews, and there are a lot that do not go how you think they're going to go. And you need to be ready to just kind of like let it happen. Like it has to be fluid. It's very kind of like jazzy in that respect.
It is. I mean, that's kind of what I've learned. I mean, you're my 21st episode, and I've been relatively inconsistent with these interviews over the past couple of years, but I'm really glad we connected, because it's holding me accountable to keep doing this on a relatively consistent basis. But anyway, yeah, like in terms of my experience, that's what I found as well, where it really is this kind of, it's not an improv, like if we were playing jazz or something, but it is, you know, having that level of adaptability. And I think it's about, you know, active listening, and it's about active watching or observing. It's really just about having presence in whatever it is you're doing, right? So it could be a conversation, an interview, a documentary film. It's like the difference is whether or not you're actually right there on the ground with it, versus just having like a standard 10 question outline that you ask everybody and it's all the same, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I've definitely been present for interviews that people have just like looked down at a note card and are like, and then how was it, you know, and then they're not listening to the answers, and like, you need to be ready for those follow-ups and dig down on things that you weren't expecting to get. There are plenty of those moments with Gabe's interview. He just like, everything he said to me was like, had me laughing and was hilarious. And I was just like, what is that? What do you mean? What is that about?
Go ahead.
Sorry. Oh, I was just going to say the other, you know, I'm the director of this, but I'm also an editor like all the time. I'm constantly editing something. And a lot of editing is about just sort of being like emotionally present for it and allowing it to affect you, and being able to be affected even though you've seen something like 20 times, 30 times, and like knowing if that's how that's going to affect other people. And then when people tell you how they feel in response to certain sections, like knowing what to do with that sort of feedback if you're going to kind of do a test screening thing with like some trusted friends or whatever.
Yeah, well, speaking of that, that's cool that you just shared that, because I was going to ask, what were some of the moments in the development of this film where, yeah, you did share like a rough cut with some friends or some colleagues, and like, were there some unexpected moments where people were like, oh, dude, this part is incredible, and like you got certain feedback that kind of informed you in how you were going to shape it from an editing standpoint? Like, were there any moments in this creative process that happened to you, and if so, what were they, or what, at what point in the film did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people like don't know entirely what to think of him because of his bands. Like, they're so abrasive and they're so sort of tongue-in-cheek and in your face. There's a very like, you know, he's not a rock star, he's not doing that sort of a thing, but there is a sort of like vaudevillian aspect to what he's doing, where there's your stage persona and there's your personal persona. And I think everyone has been very surprised by how like sweet he is, and how he's not just like, you know, blowing snot on everyone. You know, he's not Johnny Rotten. You know, he's Johnny Rotten on stage maybe, but he's not that in his real life, where, you know, you look at someone like Johnny Rotten and he's just like seemingly an asshole almost all the time. So I think him being really kind was a surprise for a lot of people. And then there were just certain feedbacks about just like pacing or structure that I got that I either took or ignored. Like, there were a couple people that didn't think I needed to show the whole music video that I show at one point, but the song's also only like 40 seconds long, and I wanted to convey that without truncating anything.
Yeah.
So people sort of get like an unadulterated intake of it. And then a couple people told me to like cut. There's a section of the film where they talk about how Gabe used to puke at shows, and there's so much wild footage of it. And there were a couple people that were like, do you need all of that in there? Because it's gross. And I went back and forth on that, and I tried some shorter cuts and was seeing how it felt. And I'm glad I kept it. I ended up keeping like my initial cut after trying quite a few more. And I'm happy I did, especially now with Gabe gone. Like I like that he's in the doc as much as he is.
Yeah. Yeah. I felt the same. And regarding the footage of him throwing up, well, for one, I was thinking to myself, like, I never fucking knew that. Like, no way. Like, I mean, I knew Locust because I never saw the Locust live.
I had neither when I started this.
Crazy. Yeah. Cause like, you know, a long time ago, from the world that I came from, as far as like the punk world, you know, I just remember when Reversal of Man and Combat Wounded Veteran went on tour with Jenny Piccolo and the Locust. And at, I don't remember what year that was, maybe 99 or something. It was a long time ago. But as a younger punk and like those, that caliber of bands playing together, I was like, damn, that is like the fucking tour of the century. And I never got to see them all together on that tour. But
yeah, I was really bummed. Like it was like the week or so after I got into the Locust, I like was starting to like look up stuff on them, and yeah. It was just like, oh, they were just here with like Cattle Decapitation and Daughters and Lightning Bolt, like all of the sudden. I'm just like, oh, cool, just like all the, my favorites all together, right. And I just didn't know.
It was a crazy time when those bands were all kind of dancing with each other. But but getting back to like the footage of, you know, Gabe. Specifically with him vomiting like after every song or whatever, it's weird. It's like, yeah, it's gross, like on paper, sure, whatever. But at the same time, what I got from it was this feeling of really kind of like almost being there. Like you're almost like on your side stage with the Locust while they're just fucking losing their shit and like dealing with asshole crowds who are heckling them and just being jerks and the way they were kind of dealing with it. And it's like, you know, you see like Justin in the front of the stage, just kind of like dealing with people. And then you have Gabe in the back vomiting in a bucket. Like, and then it's like, okay, I'm ready. And then like gets to the next fucking song. I'm like, this is insane. Like, I've been familiar with the Locust for over two decades, but like because I never saw them live, I never really knew that that was kind of going down. So it really kind of gave this clear window into the world of the Locust, you know, and like, and how they all kind of experienced that. Cause I love how you interviewed all of them and, you know, their reflections on that time. And yeah. I'm glad you kept it.
Yeah. I mean, as far as like keeping those sections, especially like elongated concert moments, I'm a big fan of documentaries that use like only like source footage and don't cut, like don't actually shoot anything new. There's that new Mars Volta one that I'm really stoked to see. That's just like only Omar's tapes that he's been shooting for like 30 years. And he used to shoot like constantly. Wow. So I'm sure it's just like thousands of hours of footage. Sure. That's like never seen the light of day. Cause it just like, okay, it's a new day. Throw a new VHS on the tape. Let's go. And then just roll for that whole day of tour or whatever. And there's one of my favorite documentaries is this one called LA 92. That's all just like source footage of the LA riots and sort of like the lead up to that. But it's all just like VHS that was shot at the time or like news footage. And like, they don't shoot anything. There's no like talking heads. There's no explanation. It's just like footage and music and that's it. And the edit is so good on it.
Where could you find that LA 92?
I think it was on Netflix forever. I'm sure if it's not on Netflix, I'm sure it's on some other streamer.
Yeah.
It's gotta be, if it's not there, it's Hulu or Pluto or Tubi or whatever. I'm sure someone has it. It's very worth watching.
Are there any other documentaries that have stood out to you over the years?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I love documentary. I think documentary is one of those, I think it's sort of a perfect genre in the sense that you can do anything with it, but people choose not to. And I think that that's...
In what way? Like, what do you mean by that?
So there's... I think that we're in, like, a real aesthetic rut with documentaries right now, especially if you look at, like, Netflix's true crime stuff. It's just, like, ominous soft pad music, drone shot of a city at night, and then,
it's a bit soapy.
Cut to a talking head in, like, an overly lit, almost setified room. And then, like, it's just, like, only that they're all edited the same exact way, where like the kind of documentaries I'm drawn to are things like, I love all of Herzog's stuff. I love Crumb, if you've never seen that, about the artist R. Crumb.
Yeah.
I love American Movie. I love Grey Gardens. Like I miss, you know, what else? Brothers Keeper, like a lot of that early HBO stuff that it was happening in like the 90s. Like there used to be a much more observational quality to documentaries. There's a much more uncontrolled, unsafe feeling to it. There's a much more organic thing. And there's also just like, frankly, like documentaries should take a long time to make. If you're truly like waiting for good footage to arise, I think that it takes time. Like one of my all-time favorites is Hoop Dreams. And that movie was supposed to be a 15-minute segment on a Chicago PBS station. And it ended up being 7 years because they wanted to follow these middle school kids that wanted to get into the NBA that lived in the inner city Chicago. And they're like, let's follow them. Let's see if they get into the NBA. Like, that's the idea, right? So they just followed these two families and saw what happened with them over the course of that entire time. And like, there's a meat grinder quality to how documentaries are being produced now that I think is like really caustic to the genre, because I think you're robbing it of it, the observational humanity. And you're also just sort of like going like, okay, well, let's just hit the plot points the way you hit plot points in like a major action movie, where it's like every 10 minutes, like there's some sort of plot change and then like the end after 90 minutes. And I think that you can get way cooler stuff than that. And there's an efficiency there that I think is leading to worse and worse work.
So tell me about the title, Don't Fall in Love with Yourself. And after that, how would you describe this film to someone who has no ties to like the underground punk scene or knows nothing about hardcore music or this world at all? Like, how would you describe this film?
The title comes from a Retox song that's just called Don't Fall in Love with Yourself. I personally hate doing titles. I think Justin and all the guys, especially in The Locust, are amazing at doing titles. I mean, bands in general of that era have so many good, hilarious titles. I love inconveniently long ones. I like sentences as opposed to like one or two words that are maybe the chorus or something.
I forgot who it was. It might have been Dave Lombardo in the film saying like, yeah, the song title is longer than the song itself. Like, referencing one of the Locust songs. I thought it was hilarious.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, but I mean, even, you know, bands like Brand New or Fear Before the March of Flames, so like any of those bands, like all were doing the same thing. And I think it's a cool thing, kind of the way that like a lot of bands right now are doing them, almost in the way that like screen names sound, where they're like doing weird like case matching kind of things or whatever. I think that stuff's fun. That said, I hate doing it. I just think that you're either good at titles or you're not, and I just end up overthinking it. And so a lot of times I'll like outsource titling. Like I'll end up doing like almost like a March Madness ranking kind of thing with friends or people involved in the project and try to whittle it down to like something that we think is going to be a strong title. Cause I feel like I'm not going to come up with stuff that's as good as like Bone Tomahawk or Dragged Across Concrete. Like there's like so many good movie titles that are hard to contend with. And so this one ended up being the title that we felt would be good for it. I think that if it was more broadly about this particular type of music, I would have stolen Jason Pettigrew's line from it, where he's talking about how like you don't have to be within the same genre, but like all of these different types of extreme genres are related because they're part of a continuum of extremity. And I feel like continuum of extremity is like a very good title potentially.
Yeah.
The way I would describe it to people that aren't into this kind of music, it's about an artist. Like I don't think ultimately it's necessarily about this kind of music. Weirdly, I've shown it to quite a few people that I'm like, these people are like normie people or like friends' parents or whatever. Like they've gotten it. And it's been very surprising to me. And I think it has to do with like, I think Justin is a particular type of American artist. I know that like he's very much eschewed any like feeling of connection to America in that sense, but I do think that he's a part of that conversation. I think that people like him or like Harmony Korine or like Gigi Allen, or the Jackass guys. Like, I think that all of those people are very particularly American. They're anarchic and they're sort of like non-ideological, aesthetically at least. And like, in that, I think it becomes very strong politically in like all of its subtext. And so I think that like, I don't think you could do what Justin's bands or even particularly the Locusts do in another country and have the same exact tone with it. I think that there's something very, very American about it. And so I think I would describe it as like a movie about an American like performance artist that you should see because there's so many crazy stories connected to it.
I think that makes perfect sense. And I think that, you know, upon watching the film, I could see where it would be easy for someone who wasn't necessarily aware of this culture that Justin's coming from, just by the context given in his life, his childhood, and kind of how one thing led to the next. And you kind of see this overall picture of this kid and all the things that came with his growing up. And I mean, to listen to him talk about his childhood, to even see his mom in the documentary, to, you know, to have him reference his dad and mm-hmm. all that stuff. It's fascinating to see in this like feature full length film, because it's all in one place where, you know, before this film, you have an idea of a band like the Locust or, you know, a band like Swing Kids or even Struggle or the plethora of bands that he's been involved in and how they've had impact on culture. I just thought it was so cool to, you know, you're obviously touching on all the things that he's been involved with creatively, but then you have this foundation of sort of how he grew up and the things that happened to him. And it just gave a much more comprehensive picture of, you know, kind of the inner workings of how this came to be in terms of the life he's been leading, you know, which is obviously one of the more unconventional ways of living, which I love. It's just like,
I don't know a ton about, you know, psychoanalysis or anything, but like obviously it always goes back to your childhood. And
for sure.
I showed the film to a friend of mine who grew up in like a very, very conservative religious household with like 12 kids, like one of those like quadruple type households. And, you know, he watched it and he was like, yeah, I mean, of course it makes sense that like he doesn't have faith in the systems around him. Like why would he have ever had that feeling given his like childhood where like everything around him had kind of failed him and he had to learn how to rely on it on his own, like, and just like find his own way without a lot of help. I think that makes a lot of sense.
I mean, absolutely. And so with all this, as far as when you kind of arrive to your final edit, you know, when you kind of knew that, okay, this is the way I want it to be shaped. This feels right. This is it. We're done. We're going to print it. What were your thoughts on like where this was going to go, who you want to kind of see this thing, and sort of what, like, where do you want this to go? And what would you like to see come out of it in terms of sharing this story about this specific person and everything that kind of surrounds him? You know, do you have any particular goals or hopes as far as what kind of impact this film might have on people within this culture and beyond?
We've only ever like self-released things. Like, I don't really, it's not one of those things where I could be like, oh, it'll be on Netflix. I don't have the resources for that. I mean, we're getting it in front of people, which is good, but it's always been a very DIY operation, the way that we've approached these things. It's, I don't want to spend years begging people for money to try to make a thing that's not going to come to fruition. So I'd rather be busy all the time on what is doable rather than what's not. And so a lot of this was just like, I'm happy for anyone to see it anywhere. You know, I don't take anyone that watches this lightly. Like, anyone that cares about your work, I think should be valued. So yeah, I mean, it's just been kind of like pulling resources and seeing who's interested in it. And like, a lot of really cool stuff has just kind of fallen in our laps. Like, we played at this great film festival in Dallas called Oak Cliff Film Festival. And we had already submitted to a ton of fests that just like we didn't get in because... a lot of the bigger film festivals like just don't care about music documentaries. They kind of just like look at them as like content or disposable or something. Or I mean, a lot of that stuff too is just politics. It's like knowing that guy that's going to be like, no, you should program this, and then immediately it's in the program. You know,
that's unfortunate, so, honestly.
Yeah, at the same time, I was going to say at the same time, like, you know, a lot of especially more important festivals like Toronto, like, I mean, they get like 20,000 film submissions. Like, there's going to be plenty of good stuff that falls through the cracks. And so, like, I don't take that kind of stuff personally.
Yeah, I guess.
But yeah, we had the people from Dallas reach out to us, and it was great. It's like the best film festival I've ever been to. And they were so nice. And like, Planet B played behind the screen, like, after the movie was over. So they have like big concerts behind like the main screen in the theater. Yeah, it's great. It's the theater where like Oswald was like captured after the Kennedy assassination.
Damn.
So it was really a really cool experience. And like, that's just because they reached out. So a lot of it is just like seizing on opportunities like that. I mean, my goals are really just like, I want to capture something important to me and Amber. I think that like, I think the strength of things like documentary are that you can preserve things that are really just like go away very quickly. Like there's like just flash in the pan things that as long as you're recording during it or you have some sort of record you can build afterwards, like that's such a great tool. One of my favorite filmmakers that I've been talking about at a lot of the Q&As is a guy named Les Blank. And like all of his films are like half hour short films that he made with grant money. And they're all about like insular little communities. It's like the war between Polish and Czech polka in Chicago in the 1970s, or like black sharecroppers that only speak French in Louisiana and like play jazz. Like, one sec, there's a plane going over.
That's okay. Yeah, it's not coming through.
Okay, cool. Yeah, but like all of his work is great, and like it's kind of the only record of a lot of that stuff. There's not a lot of like writing or other footage of those things, and like it was there and now it's gone. And he really captured the only record. And I feel like things like little music bursts that happen, like whether it be this or like the Saddle Creek explosion in Omaha, or like the stuff that Mimi in the Bathroom is about, where it's like post 9/11 New York rock. Like, I think all that stuff's really important to capture. I think that especially in the digital age, everything is disposable. It's all on mysterious servers that run the cloud. And like, if those go down, like, you know, we're talking about like, you know, a half a century of media potentially gone, you know, that we're not going to have a record of. And so I think that preserving it, those things in any way you can, is important.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to look at it. It's you're capturing a slice of culture that might otherwise just be overlooked and known by a very small set of people. Whereas now you have put this thing together that captures a moment in time that I think a lot of people are going to appreciate when they see it. Because, you know, we can all kind of go on in life with the memories and sort of like, oh yeah, I remember when I saw this band play in a basement in fucking, you know, 98 or whatever, and wherever. But having a film like this, capturing such a specific slice of music culture, art culture, and just an individual story, I think is an amazing achievement. And also it's something that, because of your love of storytelling, just as a default, I think it's amazing that, you know, you put so much time and effort and attention to this and created this thing, and now it exists. It's out there. You know, you've created like this archival piece of a very particular time of not only an individual, but a time of where these bands that JP has had association with, whether he was in them or whether it's bands who toured with the Locust or any of the other bands he's been in. Yeah, I think, you know, it's almost like you're doing like a particular service for this corner of culture, you know. It's not very common.
Thank you so much. That actually means a lot to hear.
Of course. I mean, I just think it's worth noting and acknowledging, you know, because I was going to say, like, it's not that common. You know, there's documentaries that cover certain aspects of punk rock and hardcore and stuff, but and this is just my hot take on it, you know, but your approach to this, it's like you're putting focus on a particular individual who's at the epicenter of all of these very important aspects of this culture. And I think there's like a really cool hybrid aspect to it. And almost getting back to the title, Don't Fall in Love with Yourself, it's almost like I can put it in a way where it's like Justin is almost saying that to himself, where it's like, yeah, this documentary is sort of focused around me, but look at all of this stuff that's beyond me that is like just as important, or if not more important than the individual themselves, you know? And that's not the most articulate way to put it, but anyways, I'm just trying to like connect the dots and sort of putting together my own web.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it sounds right to me. He's very self-effacing, and he's definitely the first to dismiss like his importance within that scene. But I think that it's hard to know how you're perceived. And I think that him and Gabe in particular are two people that like when they get brought up, people are like in a hush where they're like, oh, that fucking guy.
Well, yeah, I mean,
you know, and that's rare.
Kind of he's been kind of a controversial figure over the years. And I think it doesn't surprise me that he's so misunderstood, because people are so quick to judge based on, you know, the little information they have. But like you said, it's even like when his partner Becky, I think in the interview, was saying like, oh yeah, like, you know, little do people know that like Justin's just like a hippie, or like, you know, he's like into yoga and like all this other stuff. And like you said, it's like most people are thinking, well, he's blowing snot on people and like spitting on people and, you know, always controversial and going against the grain. But I think it's more so just the way Justin's able to live his philosophy as a punk, live his philosophy as an artist. He's communicating it by his actions, not by just what he's saying. You know, and that's the thing with Justin that I've always taken away from, is that he's always been like one of the realest motherfuckers out there. And,
oh, for sure.
And I've always appreciated that, even in my younger years, like just knowing The Locust was always like this kind of left of center, even from like the world I came from, and like chaotic hardcore and screamo and whatever. The Locust and Jenny Piccolo were the two bands that kind of like were hovering around, but they were always like on some other shit. And I think even then, like most people didn't really understand what it was or what they were doing. Cause you know, this is a band that had like keyboards and they were wearing outfits and they were, you know, fucking just like instigating shit on stage and stuff. But then it was crazy to learn that like beyond the shows, people were actually really pissed off by the way they were behaving or acting. Like it really like stirred shit up. And you know, the fact that they were getting in fights and people were throwing stuff at them and just being complete fucking assholes.
It's really funny, because that's one of the things that appealed to me. Like I'm not gay, but like queer art has always really appealed to me, and I think that Locust kind of qualifies for that, because they were being so sort of like feminine and just like actively rejecting the sort of like
tough guy
heteronormative patriarchal sort of macho. Like I just
totally.
You know, I remember listening to Locust, but then my friends would be going to like Bane shows and like headwalking, and it's just like, that's cool. I'm down for like a violent show, but like there's something there that's about these dudes like proving something in some way to themselves that like I just like did not have interest in. And so like that's really what resonated with me, was, you know, I'm like a fairly like femme guy who like I'm thin, and like I've never felt to like being tough, like I can't hold muscle in my body, and so like, yeah, I've always preferred to be like the weirdo with the camera in the corner of like a show, as opposed to just like fucking throwing fists. So yeah, I mean, like the fact that they were going into these spaces that had such a very clear power structure built into them, and just being like, oh fuck that, and kind of doing it with a sense of like abandon that feels very brave to me, is really, really exciting and appealing.
Absolutely. I mean, I agree. And I think that's what I was drawn to back in the day as well. When I learned of 31G and all the bands that he was putting out back in the day, and how these bands had such an expressive quality to them, but they weren't tough, but they were still like heavy and violent and like just chaotic. And that's what really appealed to me, and still does appeal to me. I mean, growing up in Connecticut, I was exposed to a lot of youth crew, and we would call it tough guy hardcore back in the day, like stuff like Hatebreed and you know, and then there's a lot of straight edge, and there was a lot of metalcore too. Like, speaking of new metal, like I feel like the early bands like Vision of Disorder and Overcast and all those types of bands were passing through Connecticut every weekend almost, it seemed. But
well, once I... And I feel like the Locust, and I mean honestly a lot of stuff on 3-1-G, I mean even like stuff like Blood Brothers or like Airborne Radar, I think that they have more in common with like the hardcore boom we're seeing now than the hardcore boom that they were a part of. And I know I've said this at Q&A's, and I feel like there's like some hesitancy to like admit that from, you know, from the guys involved with that scene. But I think it's true. Like, I think that like they have more in common with a band like For Your Health. Like, I know you guys know them, like, or like Callous Dowboys or whatever. Like, I think that there's such a cool boom of like very integrated queer weirdo hardcore that's happening right now, where it's just like, oh yeah, let's just throw a saxophone on this tour and we'll have fucking a keyboard, and then like two of the members in the band are trans, like, and like that's fucking awesome. Like, and I think that that's the wave of bands that are coming out right now is just so exciting to me, in the sense that like there's so much good energy at the shows, and it's so inclusive, and it feels like it's genuinely a space that's building communities and not just trying to make a space for some dude in jorts to like feel good when he gets wasted on Friday, you know?
Totally. Yeah, I mean, it's a different landscape now, and I love seeing it. It's like there's been a level of scalability to this type of scene and culture, just I think by the nature of internet and access, versus, you know, 20 plus years ago, when a lot of these bands, like the 3-1-G bands, or, you know, even Drum's Dream was not, we, you know, my band was not really accepted for a really long time, because we weren't playing, you know, 4/4 fucking, I don't know, just like straightforward beats that have like breakdowns and stuff. We were doing weirdo shit, and it wasn't until we started seeing bands from other corners of the country, like the Locust or Reversal of Man or Page 99, and of course Orchid, and like, you know, all these bands that were playing really aggressive and expressive music, but they weren't wearing basketball jerseys and like having this like real macho kind of identity paired with it. And that's what I was always drawn to, was it's not like these bands were giving each other permission to be weird and just to not like fit any kind of mold. They were just doing it because that's who they were. And that's what I loved so much back then. But I love, to your point about the current landscape in punk and hardcore and just music in general, is that there's a space for it all. And it's more understood now than I think it was 20 plus years ago. And I love seeing that too. Just the fact that these kids can get in a room and be who they are and not have to worry about getting beat up. You know, they're in a positive environment amongst peers who understand that they're all there for a specific reason, their own individual reasons, but knowing that it's, you know, it's a safe space, or it should be a safe space. You know, I always felt that punk should be a place where people could just be who they are and not give a shit, you know? And this is why I think, again, getting, you know, tying it back to Justin and this documentary and what it highlights is, you know, there shouldn't be any rules within punk. There shouldn't be any rules within art. And this is the thing that I think Justin has always worn on his sleeve. And again, through action, not just talk, like he is living that. He's living that freedom. He's been kind of this sort of public example of just doing whatever the fuck you want and being who you are unapologetically. And I think, you know, a lot of these younger kids and bands who are doing just that might not be super familiar with Justin. They might know the Locust. They might, you know, be familiar with Justin Pearson as an individual, but it still might, I don't know, maybe there's like, I mean, there's quite a gap in time, which is wild to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like all the members of the audience might not know him, but he definitely, like, all the young bands that I've talked to, like, do know him. Yes. Like, so I think he's had a very like musician in the sense that I think he's having a ton of influence indirectly through other people that admire his work, as opposed to, you know, being as notable as I think he should be, where like every person at that Gel show is like, oh yeah, no, I also like this band.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of interviewing him. I think it was like a couple of years ago, actually, when I was just starting the podcast. And I think that was right before the pandemic hit, or maybe it was during. I don't remember exactly.
I think it was during. I remember listening to it.
Nice. Yeah, it was such a random time, but I felt compelled to reach out to him. And we hadn't met before, but, you know, we just hit the ground running because I think that familiarity of coming from a similar background and you know, having like mutual friends and stuff, it was really nice to just hit the ground and start chatting with him. And it was clear to me that upon getting on the phone with him, that he was a real one, that he was like more present and transparent and forthcoming and just no bullshit than I could have even expected. You know, I wouldn't say that it surprised me, but it was really cool to come off that conversation / interview, you know, saying to myself, like, man, this guy, he's everything. He's like everything I could have imagined and more, in terms of just his talking the talk and walking the walk, just as an artist, you know, as a creative person, and just like a humble, genuine dude.
Yeah, you know, I've met very few people that are more down than him for anything. You know, when you make movies on people, it's not necessarily expected that like they're gonna be involved in the rollout or they're gonna like be that supportive. It's like, no, I've already let you like tell my story, I'm good, I'm gonna go over here, you know, which is absolutely fine. But he has been like so supportive through this. He's been completely down. We've done a ton of those screenings where we go and do Q&A's at different theaters in different cities, and like every single time he's always into it. And like I keep waiting. It just like when we did the interview, like I was like waiting for him to get the burnout that other people do, and it's just like, he's like, no, how can we keep doing it? Let's keep going, let's do more, let's find cooler things to do with this release. And so it's been like a really fun creative experience, actually, you know, making a movie about him and his work and then actually becoming kind of part of that work too, where we're collaborating together on the release of this and like really bolstering it together.
Yeah, truly, truly like a special collaboration. Mm-hmm. So what's next for the film? I know that it's available. I believe it's on Vimeo for purchase and for rent, or what's happening now with the film?
Yeah. So for right now it's on rental and purchase, on VHX and Vimeo. We have links to it on our website, turnstilefilms.com, spelled with a Y.
Nice. And I'll make sure those links are in our description as well, so everyone can just click and check out that. And
yeah, and it's also available on Blu-ray, but the numbers are starting to get pretty low. From Vinegar Syndrome, who are just like amazing people on the East Coast, they're doing insane work with their distribution company.
Nice.
But that has limited edition art from Chris Norris, aka Steak Mountain, that you just did that interview with.
Yeah. I was gonna bring that up, but
yeah.
Just the fact that Chris is involved as well. I love Christopher. I also saw that Alex Edkins and
It's Graham from Holy Fuck, and right. It's Alex from Mets.
Yes, and so they played a role in the scoring of this, right? And including Luke Henshaw, of course, of Planet B.
Yeah.
But so how did they get involved?
They offered to score the movie. Like, I just woke up to an email one day, and they're like, hi, this is Alex from Mets and Graham from Holy Fuck. You know those two bands you totally love? Like when Latin by Holy Fuck came out, like it like took over my life for a year. That album was so good. But yeah, I just woke up to that email and they're just like, hey, we love Justin. We're trying to do more scoring work. We have this scoring project we're doing together.
Right.
And can we score your movie? And I was just like, yeah, of course. Like, I hadn't started yet. Luke had already agreed to it. And so I just shot Luke a message and was just like, are you cool with collaborating with these guys? And he's just like, yeah, of course. Why wouldn't I be?
Yeah, it's perfect. So, I mean, when I saw the rolling credits and I saw them come up, I'm like, oh shit, that's fucking perfect. Like, it makes total sense. And then it reminded me of when I spoke to Alex a couple months ago on the pod, and he had mentioned yeah, that he was working with Graham Walsh of Holy Fuck. And so I was really happy to see that they were involved. And, you know, I know that that they have a longstanding relationship with Justin. So it made me happy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Those guys are great. Yeah. I'm so happy with how the score turned out, and we're going to be doing something fun with it. I don't want to like spill the beans. We have a couple other cool, fun release type things that we're doing with the rollout going into the end of the year. So there's definitely like a few more phases to this before it's done, but yeah. I don't think I can like, you know, blow up the spot yet.
Well, people, they need to stay on the lookout and keep up on all things. Follow Turnstile Films, follow John Nix on Instagram and all that good stuff. You know, I just have to congratulate you again on this film, because I think it's not just a documentary film. It's a real important archival piece that I think, you know, looking back on it years from now, I think so many people are just going to be so happy that it exists and for us to look back on. You know, when I sat to the very end and I saw the outtakes of Gabe, it really made me sad, but it was also like, wow, like how cool is it that you were able to spend that time with him and to have those experiences, you know, face to face, and to capture it, you know, again, like mm-hmm. that's kind of like a whole other element of surprise, you know, in the process of making this film. And you know, I don't know if there's anything you want to speak to regarding that and your
for sure, man,
experience with him. But I mean, obviously that was you know, the loss of him, but of course you working with him and making this film, I mean, that must have been kind of you know, a real derailer, of course.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he got to see it finished, so that's cool.
I can
tell a story about that. Yeah, man, it was so fucking cool. Like, Gabe always represented something so pure to me about art. There's just something about his drumming that, like, I'm not a musician, and like, so I can't necessarily pick out every aspect of what's happening in a song when I like it. Like, there's definitely things that I just chalk up to like production or vibe or whatever, but like I just like keyed in on everything he was doing, and I would like watch, you know, like those drum cover videos of his stuff when people start putting those up on YouTube, and like there's just something about his work that's just like so singular that like I don't think anyone else can touch. As far as I'm concerned, he's always gonna be my favorite drummer of all time. I don't see anyone like getting over on him. So to like meet him and become his friend was like insane to me. Because like we shot that interview and we were pretty fresh when we did the interview. Like, we hadn't talked a ton other than like, I think I met him at a Head Wound City show and we both just kind of chit-chatted. But after that, like, he was really great about staying in touch. We would text all the time when I would put up new photography or whatever. Like, he would just be like, "You're killing it, dude. It's great. Keep going," you know? So yeah. He's like this like great cheerleader. And it blew my mind the first few times it happened. I was like, what the fuck is happening? Why is this happening? I remember when I sent him the first like real solid cut of the movie. It wasn't like the finished product that, you know, people can see now, but I would say it's like 85-90% of it. And it was like to kind of get his approval on everything, because I could see him being self-conscious about, you know, barfing for 15 minutes in the middle of it. But yeah, I sent it to him, and I didn't hear anything back right away. And then a couple hours later, Justin texted me, and he's like, "Gabe just texted me, I love you, out of nowhere. Like, is everything okay? Like, is everything all right?" And I'm like, "Oh, I sent him a link to the movie." And he's just like, "Oh, okay." And so they had like a really good conversation after seeing it, kind of reflecting on the things they'd done. But, and then he sent me a big, you know, like, thank you kind of like brick text, about the movie. So yeah, it was like a really fun, great moment to have. Yeah, yeah,